Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Dr. Daryl Ray, our speaker tonight, is the founder and president of Recovering from Religion, and he has been a psychologist for over 30 years and is the author of 4 books, including The God Virus, How Religion Infects Our Lives and Culture, and Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality, which I've read both of recently and can highly recommend. Actually, I listened to them on Audible, but you know, you can read or listen to them. It's fine. Dr. Ray has been a student of religion for most of his life and actually holds a master's degree in religion, as well as a bachelor's degree in sociology and anthropology, and a doctorate in psychology. So very highly credentialed, and we are super excited for tonight's talk. So Dr. Ray, take it away.
All right. Thanks, Kara. Well, first of all, let me just say thanks for having me again here. I didn't turn too many people off the last time I talked about sex, so you must have liked the sexy talking that we did. So let's begin here. My purpose is to try and expand your view of sex and sexuality through the lens of science tonight. And I just want to confess right up front that there's no way for me to live up to the title of this of this talk. So it was kind of false advertising. I couldn't possibly talk about all the science around sex. But what I do want to do is expose you to some new ideas, some research, some observations about sex and sexuality that will help you start asking your own questions. Because ultimately, we all have to define our sexuality ourselves and for ourselves. And second is, I want you to recognize that most of what you learned, if not all of what you learned, especially if you're a Southern Baptist, was a myth. Whatever you learned about sex in a Southern Baptist evidence-only class probably was about 172% wrong. And I don't mean it was just wrong. It was actually damaging, because there's almost no evidence for a lot of the stuff that they're claiming. And even some of that evidence is questionable. So let's begin at the beginning. Why is there sex? I mean, the very notion that there's sex on this planet, I think, is an interesting question. And nobody really knows the fundamental answer for why there is sex. But Carl Zimmer, in his book, Parasite Rex, he wrote it about 20 years ago now. It's a really interesting book. If you want to read about parasites, fine. I will say that if you do read it, don't blame me if you have nightmares for years afterwards about parasites. But anyway, Carl Zimmer espouses the theory, and as do other scientists, that sex came about as a very successful tool for staying ahead of parasites. So if you mix your genes up fast enough and often enough, parasites will have a hard time keeping up with it. And there's quite a bit of evidence that points in that direction. But at this point in time, I don't think anybody really knows the final answer for why there is sex. But we also know that there's probably, it may have begun that way, but since it began as a parasite avoidance mechanism, it has mutated and evolved to serve other purposes in many different species. And that's something that's going to be of interest to us tonight. So I also want to have a step outside of our human-centric view of sexuality. If I stepped outside my house right now, as some of you know, I live out in the country, I would hear tree frogs trying to get laid tonight. I would hear cicadas trying their best to have sex. And you know what? If they don't get it tonight, they may never get it. It's a one and done thing for so many animals, especially insects. You guys on the East Coast have been going through the cicada thing. It's a one and done every 17 years for them. I mean, they're a child and an adolescent underneath the ground for 17 years, and then they get a 1 week of adulthood. So they're jumping out of the ground and coming up in the trees and hollering and screaming all night long to try and find somebody to have sex with. And that's the life of a cicada. It doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun to me, but I don't want to be a cicada if I come back in a if there is reincarnation, I don't want to come back as a cicada. We're getting ready to get in. I'm going to jump right into the pornography part of my talk. If you don't like pornography, you don't have to look at it. You know, it's kind of like a lot of things. If you don't like it, you don't need to do it. But I'm going to start by saying that all sex organs are the fastest organs of any organism. No matter what organism, if it is a sexually reproducing species, its sex organs are evolving the fastest of any other component in that species. And so I'm going to show you some sex organ pictures here. So be ready if you need to close your eyes. This is a sex organ. Now, I want to show you another one because this is a sex organ too. Now, compare these two. These are not the same species, but they're very closely related. Look at that one. It's not the same species either, but it's very closely related. And this is a very different species, but they have, you can see just by the way the sex organs are, that they're very similar in many ways with little variations. Well, what this tells us is the sex organs of flowers are constantly evolving. Charles Lamarck, the guy that created the classification system. Help me out if you remember.
Oh, Linnaeus.
Linnaeus, right. Sorry about that. Thank you, Kara. You have saved my bacon for today. Linnaeus created the classification system. And he got accused of being a sex pervert because all he could think about was sex. Well, what he figured out quite amazingly was the best way to identify a plant is through its sex organs. Because the sex organs, you know, he didn't know this because he was doing his system in the 1790s, early 1800s, long before, or about 50 or 60 years before Darwin. So he didn't realize what he had discovered was that sex organs, while similar plants, can be very different because sex organs, we'll just underline that in your mind again, sex organs are evolving faster than any other organ in your body. So animals also have sex organs, as we know, and they are evolving rapidly as well. Here's our Argentine bluebill, which Gail and Glenda will love so much. And I'm not going to do my duck sex talk completely tonight. I'm just going to do part of it. But what we realize is in animals, they all have different sex organs. One duck does not have the same sex organs as another duck does. The Argentine bluebill has got its own particular sex organ approach. And I'm going to show you, again, we're getting ready to get into pornography here. I'm getting ready to show you a movie of an Argentine bluebill with an erection. Okay, let's watch this very closely. Pay attention because we've slowed this movie down 10 times so you can really see it in great detail. But here's the duck. That's the penis of the duck. All right. So does that look, if you're a penis owner or if you've ever interacted with a penis, you know, face to face or whatever, you'd probably notice it doesn't look like that one. I don't know. Most people don't look like that. And what you may not realize is that penis right there is operating off of a different pressure system. If you're a human penis owner, your penis operates off of the blood pressure system. Whereas this one is, this penis is operating off of the lymphatic system. So the pressure of the lymphatic system actually takes and blows up. It's like a reverse balloon or a balloon kind of, it just blows it up and creates this corkscrew kind of penis. Now, these two species are both sexually reproducing, whether a human species, let's say, and a duck, but they're reproducing with a vaginal tract, a reproductive tract, and with a penis, but they're radically different. You almost can't get any more different than this right here in this picture. Here is a picture of a duck vagina and a picture of a duck penis. Now, there's a different species of duck in this case, but the species, the penis and the vagina are matched up. They're from the same species. Just one's the male, one's the female in this case. And for years, people were recognizing that male ducks were really into rape. I used to own ducks. If you've ever been to my house, I used to have 23 ducks. And I noticed that ducks were always having sex or trying to have sex, or the males were trying to have sex. If the female liked the male, then she would kind of waddle around and act real sexy in front of him, and he would hop on. And I think the amount, the time frame of a male to ejaculate into the female is about 1.3 seconds. I mean, it is over just like that. The film we just saw a minute ago was slowed down 10 times. So you can imagine that's how fast a duck is penetrating and ejaculating into the female, into female duck. Well, what they noticed was that after she was mated, the other males came on and tried to mate with her. Well, she didn't want that. She didn't like the other males. She didn't want to mate with them. And what would happen was the males would literally gang up on her and rape her. So they've noticed this for decades. Biologists have noticed. I noticed it in my own front yard that ducks, male ducks, would rape. And I think it's rape because she did not want it. She would do anything she could to get away from it. She would even dive under the water. Some people have reported the female ducks will drown trying to get away from males that are trying to rape her. So it is alive and well among the duck populations. Cute as the little people are, duckies, they can be pretty rapey, if you will. Well, there was a question, who's having the babies here then? Is it the guy she likes or is it the rapist? Excuse me. So Dr. Patricia Brennan, of the University of Edinburgh, decided to do a radical experiment. For years, the male biologists were saying, well, the corkscrew is made to penetrate quickly and all this. They had a very male-oriented view of what was going on with the female duck. And she said, well, let's do something radical. Let's open up the female duck and look at her reproductive tract and see what it looks like. And the males had never thought about doing that, I guess, because they were all surprised that the female vagina, which is on the left here, looks a whole lot like the male penis in reverse. And so they had to start asking the question, what's going on here? And what they discovered was the female can shut that whole thing down, to use the term of a former Senate candidate from Missouri. Eric, you may remember that. Shut that old female thing down.
He just had the wrong species, that was all.
Yeah, it's all he had. Humans cannot shut that whole thing down, but ducks can. And what they found was when the male duck that she likes mates with her, she loosens that whole tract up so the sperm can go deep into the vaginal tract and fertilize the egg. If she doesn't like the male that's trying to have sex with her, she can ratchet it down. She can twist it up, and there's little pockets of all over this vaginal tract that will trap semen, stop it from going any farther. So the female duck really has a response to the male rape culture of ducks. It's kind of interesting when you look at it. The male has evolved a penis to get in deep and fast. The female has evolved a vaginal tract to prevent deep and make it slow, even restrict the whole swimming of the sperm. It's quite an interesting thing. This is called coevolution. It's called antagonistic coevolution, if you want a word for it. And we see this in lots and lots of species. Lots of species have a male with one mating strategy and a female with a different mating strategy that's antagonistic to what the female wants. It's everywhere in nature. It's in water striders. It's in other kinds of mammals, including us, which we'll talk about pretty soon. Here's another penis here. This is the four-headed penis of an echidna called the spiny anteater. It's in Australia. I've had the opportunity to actually hold one of these little guys. And if you hold them, you do that very carefully because those little spines are really sharp. It's like trying to hold a porcupine. But as long as you're feeding it some milk, it won't stick. Yeah, that's what we were doing. Now, the spiny anteater has got four heads on its penis, but it only uses two of those heads. The two middle heads are for ejaculation. We're not sure what the other two heads are for. And I haven't seen any research on the female reproductive tract. There's only they're a monotreme, and there's only two species of monotremes on the planet. And the other one, any chance you know what that is?
The platypus?
Exactly, right. You saw the earlier talk, so you already know that. No.
Yes, that's why.
No, yeah. Yeah, the platypus and the anteater, spiny anteater, echidna, are the only two monotremes on the planet, and they lay eggs, which puts them really in an unusual place as well. So this is just another example of a penis. Now, I'm going to answer the question a little bit later. Why am I showing you all these penises and vaginas and all that sort of stuff? But I want to get, once you get in your head that I am showing you a tiny, tiny sample of all the different kinds of penises. Here's another one. I'll let you read that. The male Argonaut octopus.
Okay. It's a picture of an octopus. The male Argonaut octopus is in danger of being eaten by females. So instead of mounting his mate, he will literally rip his penis off and throw it at the female so she can inseminate on her own, which is simply the most fantastic go fuck yourself ever. Wow.
Yeah. She doesn't even need a dildo. She can just do it right there. So there you go.
So she like bobbits right off.
I guess. I don't know. I'm not an octopus. I've never seen this before, but it seems like a very interesting way to mate. Again, another way to do the whole mating thing, the whole penis thing. Here's another penis. This is from the bonobo apes. You may have heard about the bonobos. We have four great apes. We got the gorillas, we got the chimpanzees, we got the bonobos, and we got the humans. We're all a part of that same group. And if you look carefully at this penis here, you'll notice it doesn't look like a human penis at all. It's really long. And if you just take your finger and stick it out and taper a little bit more, that's basically what the bonobo's penis looks like. Now, you'll notice here on the left, upper left corner picture, those are two female bonobos having sex, because female bonobos like to have sex. And they like to have sex, oftentimes missionary position, and they like to rub clitorises. Now, as you can see by what you see here, they have ginormous clitorises. I mean, these are huge clitorises, and they seem to really enjoy rubbing them against each other. And even some of the researchers of the bonobos have shown that they seem to have orgasms, much like humans do, and they make a hell of a lot of noise when they're having orgasms. I've had a few girlfriends that really like to make a lot of noise too. So there's something about making noise and enjoying yourself with female bonobos and some female humans even. So why? Let's ask a few questions and I'll come back and try to answer a few of them. I'm not going to answer all these questions, but why is the human penis so large? It is large relative to our body size. Why is the human penis shaped so different from other primates? I've shown you a lot of other penises already, and not one of them looks like a human. Why does human sex last so long? Most sex, I mean, I think sex lasts about 30 seconds with a bonobo. There's no primate that really has coitus, actually penetrative sex that lasts more than about 30 to 60 seconds at the most. Now human sex lasts about 4 times that long to 10 times that long. So why are human testes larger than a gorilla's? Gorillas have very small testes, but smaller than a bonobo or a chimp. Why is the human sperm have so many different kinds of sperm in it? There's not just one kind of sperm. There's a lot of different flavors, so to speak. Why do women have hidden estrus? We'll come back to that in a second. Why is the female reproductive tract so hostile to sperm? Yes, it is very hostile to sperm most of the time. And why do women have breasts? We'll come right back to that a little bit later as well. We'll try to answer three or four of those questions here. So this is the original penis pump. A guy named Dr. Robin Baker out of, I believe this is the University of Bristol, I think. No, University of Manchester in England. I don't know why it's all the English doing this research, probably because most of the research is being done during the George Bush administration when they didn't allow sex research. Of course, they still don't allow too much of it now. But the original, what Robin Baker had the question, why is the human penis shaped the way it is? And that penis does not look like anything I've shown you so far, but it does bear similarities to other penises. For example, there's quite a few different species, especially among insects, that have something called the bottle brush penis. You know what a bottle brush, if you ever had a baby and you had to clean the bottles out, you know what a bottle brush is. Well, the reason you're using a bottle brush is to get everything out of the bottle. And that's what the bottle brush does among water striders. Each water strider species that's out on my pond right now, and there's something like 14 different species of water striders on any given pond. And they all look alike to our eyes. But if you're a biologist, you get down in a microscope and you look, you'll find that they're all different. Now, how do you know they're different? Because their penises are different. Look at the bottle brush penis of one, and it'll have so many bristles. The other one will have a wholly different arrangement of bristles, and that shows you it's a different species, because the sex organs are evolving faster than any other part of the body. And that seems to have been what happened to humans. We have evolved a strategy for sex, and the strategy always includes the shape, the physical shape of the vagina and the physical shape of the penis, because those two are going together. And they're also competing against each other in antagonistic co-evolution. Now, why is it shaped like this? Robin Baker asked that question. So he did a radical experiment. He went down to the porn shop and got one of those newfangled, very accurate vaginas and got a dildo, normal size dildo, and he got some fluid that had the viscosity of semen, and he squirted the semen into the vagina, and then he took the dildo and put it in and pumped it to see what would happen. And what he found was about 80% of all the liquid he had pumped in got pumped out by that penis. What was going on? Well, if you look at the way the penis works, when it's erect, it's smooth on the top and it allows for fluid to flow over it. But when the penis comes out, the coronal ridge around the edge pulls the fluid out and gets rid of it. And then it goes back in to get another load and come out and go back in, get another one and come out. It takes a while to pump a vagina out. Now, you're probably asking the question, why would you want to pump a vagina out? The answer to that is because somebody else was already there before you. And you want to get in there and get the other guy's semen out. And then you want to deposit your own semen. And that's what's going on. What he found is we can pump 80% of the other guys out. And then you ejaculate your own into the vagina. And hopefully nobody comes and pumps yours out, by the way. And what will end up happening is you'll get to fertilize the eggs most of the time. Now, we've been told since we were little kids in our churches and by our culture that humans are a monogamous species. Now, why do we need to have a penis pump if we're a monogamous species? Just asking the question here. Think about that. Evidently, something else was going on. There's probably a lot of hanky-panky going on somewhere. By the way, the chimps and the bonobos have a different strategy. Their penises are not shaped like that. And they're our closest relatives. I mean, they are really, really close to us. And yet their penises are different because remember what I said, Sex organs are the fastest evolving organs in your body. And that's what's going on. We've only been separated by a few million years, and yet their penises are very different. And their mating strategy is different. They are the bonobos and the chimps' mating strategy is flush the other guy out. And that's why they have enormous testes. They can produce prodigious amounts of semen. And when they mate, they push all their semen in to try and flush the other guy out with a deep enough squirt, and most enough of it, they will overcompete with the guy that was there the last time. And we clearly know that these are not monogamous species. And I'll come back to actually answering the question about monogamy in a minute. So there's so much interesting just looking, whether it's a human sexual reproductive tract in the female or a male reproductive tract, it matters not. They tell us a lot about the species itself. There's one other thing about the species, any mammalian species, and that is the bigger the difference between the two the male and the female of a given species, the more females the male mates with. So you get a gorilla that generally has 3 to 4 females that he dominates, and or a gibbon, which males and females are almost always equal in size, and they tend to mate for life and be fairly monogamous. So again, we look at humans and say, how much difference is there? Average difference between the males and females. And that tells us something about how many females a male tends to mate with. And we have a lot of evidence for this as well, by the way. Here's a simple fact, and you can take this to the bank. 80% of all women in recent history, and by recent history, I mean, say the last 5,000 years, 80% of all women have actually reproduced. They've had children that survived and had children. They've had grandchildren, if you will. Only 40% of males have reproduced. But think about that. 80% of the women have reproduced. 40% of the males have reproduced. What is going on? Well, there's a lot going on there. And that tells us a little bit. Remember, there's a difference in size between the two. If you look at history, how many cultures had polygamous cultures where the male, the alpha male got to dominate multiple females in a harem, for example, in Islam or something like that. So there's in China where the king might have 1,000 wives. And somebody's going without a wife because the king got them all, so to speak. So there's that going on. And the fact that many cultures have rituals in which the boy can't mate until he's past a certain puberty or certain mating, certain rituals, like going out and hunting or killing an enemy or hunting and bringing back meat or food. And in the process of doing that, a lot of boys get killed. We also know that in birth, male children die more often than female children, babies. Male babies die more often than female. In fact, there's a birth ratio that you can look at in most cultures. And in almost all cultures, baby boys are dying more often than baby girls are. So there's a whole push towards one side or the other in biology. And it's not just in humans, it's in lots of other species too. There's really not any species where there's an equal mating between males and females. There are a few, but not very many. So why is the length of sex so long? I mean, I told you earlier, because of the penis pump, and the human sex lasts 4 to 10 minutes. And our penis is made for pumping out other kinds of stuff. So this answers some of our questions earlier. The main issue, though, is that at the end of sex, the penis deflates. You know, it just goes like that down to that. And that is very important because you don't want to keep pumping after you've injected your own semen in there. You want to stop pumping because you don't want to pump your own semen out. It works beautifully. If you're a human, it would not work if you're a bonobo. That's not the way they operate. and it wouldn't work if you're a cicada either. So what we're seeing here is a battle, not of the sexes. We are not in a battle of the sexes. We are in a battle of the sex organs. Sex organs are constantly evolving because each of the two mates wants to control the reproductive act if they can. And of course, that's impossible. So if I can get a little advantage, the duck can get a little advantage, the female can duck get a little advantage over the male duck, then she will decide who gets to fertilize the eggs or vice versa. If you, no matter what species you look at, you're going to see that there's always a battle of the sex organs. And I'll bet they never told you that in Sunday school class. There's probably some information here that the good old Southern Baptists or the Jehovah's Witnesses forgot to put into their abstinence only courses. So now let's move on to hidden estrus. What is hidden estrus? As a species, as I've already mentioned many times, we have our own mating strategy. If you went into the jungles with Jane Goodall and you said, "Hey Jane, show me a chimpanzee that's ready to mate," she would look at you, "Don't you already know this?" Because it's such a common thing. We know that chimpanzee females have an engorged red butt that kind of advertises, "I am ready to mate." Baboons, same kind of thing. "I am ready to mate." There is no doubt in anybody's mind in the chimpanzee troop who is ready to have their eggs fertilized. Now, who gets to mate with that female is a whole nother question. But the estrus is simply the cycle of fertility. The estrus is publicly known. Everybody knows it. Now, in humans and in bonobos, two species, and there's more, estrus is hidden. You cannot look at a female bonobo. You cannot look at a female human and tell if they're ready to have their eggs fertilized. So there's a really interesting question. Why do humans and why do bonobos hide their estrus? Why do they have to hide it? Why not advertise it? Many, many species advertise their fertility. And not just among the apes, I mean the baboons or chimpanzees, it's lots of other species advertise their fertility. But we do not do that, and neither do the bonobos. Now, there's some new evidence and some new theories about this, but I'm not going to say we have the final word. I just think there was a great article by P.Z. Myers about 5 years ago on this, and he identified that there are five species on the planet that have hidden estrus. They actually hide their fertility from the public, so to speak, from any other parts of their species. And what he outlined was the evidence that hidden estrus is generally a part of a species that depends on strong bonding. So if you want to have bonding and you want to use sex as the way to do that bonding, then hiding the estrus so that the male doesn't know when is the opportune time to mate means the male's going to mate many more times. And that's going to produce some of the oxytocin and vasopressin that causes the bonding between two animals. Whether those animals be chimpanzees or prairie voles or humans, it's the same chemical, the same hormone that's causing the bonding between the two. And that appears to be why we have hidden estrus. The female wants to hide it so that more sex will happen, more bonding will happen. Now, why do we need more bonding? Primarily because our babies are pretty hard to raise and they're very, very vulnerable for the first 3 or 4 years of their life. So keeping the male around is a good way to ensure the survival of that baby. That seems to be what's probably going on here with us. It also seems to be what's going on with some of the other species that have hidden estrus. All right, now let's get on to my favorite topic, of course, and that's masturbation. A lot of species have been observed masturbating. I used to have a male dog that liked to masturbate on my leg pretty regularly. You have to work at teaching them that's inappropriate behavior. But what is masturbation for? Masturbation's got some real functions, especially among humans. And that is the first function is to keeping the pipes clean. Sperm only have a shelf life of about 5 days. So if you haven't jacked off in the last 5 days as a penis owner, then your sperm are getting senile. And that's the word they use in biology. Those sperm are getting senile. They're getting forgetful. They don't know how to do their job. So you don't want to have senile sperm. So that just tells us right there, you got to masturbate at least once every 5 days. That's Daryl's prescription. Masturbate at least once every 5 days. On the female side of it all, if you masturbate on a regular basis, it seems to have real benefits for the reproductive tract, for the immune system in the reproductive tract. It also keeps the female reproductive tract more responsive. Women who masturbate on a regular basis seem to have better orgasms and more orgasms with or without a partner. Now, that's probably because they are getting lots of practice at it. I mean, I've had people come into my office and say, people with a vagina, saying, I can't get an orgasm. And I would ask a simple question, can you give yourself an orgasm by masturbating? And they turn white and say, oh no, I can't do that because, you know, I'm ashamed of my body. I can't touch myself. And as a result, they've never learned how to give themselves orgasm, and they're expecting their partner to do that for them. So of course my answer is, well, if you can't do it for yourself, how can you expect your partner to do it for you? So masturbation has a lot of benefits for humans. It also allows you to sleep better, both males and females. And it also keeps the prostate for men. It's looking like there's some evidence that men who stimulate their prostate regularly through masturbation aren't as susceptible to prostate cancer. So I'm all in favor of preventing cancer here. And you should be too, by the way. So we're trying to keep the pipes clean. Here's a quote from Science News in 2012. This is from some research. For animals that produce sperm continuously, such as men, the implications seem to be that more frequent ejaculations serve both to remove older and less viable sperm, as well as reduce the damage to sperm cells during storage. So this is from some scientific research that was done back in 2012. Now, next is the myth that we've all heard, and that is that we're a monogamous species. If you've never seen the book, I highly recommend Barash and Lipton's book, The Myth of Monogamy. We've always heard that swans are a monogamous species. We've heard that humans are a monogamous species. There's a lot of species that supposedly are monogamous. But chances are whatever you heard was incorrect at the least. A lot of the research around birds found that all the birds that we thought were monogamous were monogamous in one way, but not the other way. There's two kinds of monogamy I want to introduce you to here today. The first is social monogamy. Swans appear to be socially monogamous. That is, they pair bond with another opposite sex kind of bird, and they may stay that way for the rest of their life. But that doesn't mean they're sexually monogamous. She or he may be sneaking out trying to have sex with somebody else. And the way we know this is because if you look at the eggs in the nest and you do a DNA test, a paternity test, if you will, you'll find that somewhere between 10 and 20% of all the eggs in that nest belong to some other guy. So the guy that's sitting on them wasn't the one that fertilized that particular egg. And sometimes it's far more than that. So I think it's important for us to distinguish here today in this talk. I want you to think about this. There's two kinds of monogamy. There's social monogamy and there's sexual monogamy. Now, that preacher that I just read about today, who was socially monogamous with his wife, but he was having an affair with his best friend, pro baseball pitcher's wife, who plays for the Chicago Cubs. That's a little bit of a scandal here. The minister having an affair with the baseball pitcher who was the MVP in 2016 for the Chicago Cubs World Series. I can't remember his name right now. Anybody remember the name of the pitcher? He took off 6 months because he found out his wife was having an affair. He tried to get it all taken care of. It didn't work. They're divorced now. But so what we got is a great illustration of being socially monogamous, but not sexually monogamous. Now, I'm not endorsing what happened here. It was clearly cheating. But anytime you have sex with more than one person in your lifetime, you're no longer monogamous. It's that simple. There's a fish called the anglerfish that the male is teeny tiny and embeds itself into the giant female and stays there the rest of his life. And that is monogamy, one sex partner for life. Of course, she's been found to have more than one male in there too. So she's kind of playing the game so as well. So if somebody tells you that you just want to have sex like an animal, then I'm here to tell you, or the Pope, for example, the Pope says you just want to have sex like an animal has sex. I will tell you that very few animals have sex like the Pope says you should have sex. It's, as humans, we have the capacity to have sex anytime we want to. We can masturbate anytime we want to. We have an amazing amount of sexual energy, and we can express that outside of our estrous cycle. Females can have sex without being fertile, and males can have sex with somebody whether they're fertile or not. So the Pope says only have sex for reproductive purposes. That's the way dogs work. That's the way cicadas work. That's the way frogs work. I never saw a frog masturbate. So that's what we're looking at here. The Pope doesn't have a clue about human sexuality. He doesn't even have a clue about frog sexuality, probably, or any of the others. So I want to talk just briefly about the myth of the gender binary, because every church that I've been in, not the Unitarians, of course, but most of the other flavors of church and religions, whether it be Muslim or Hindu, Buddhist, they all have this binary concept of gender, that there's only two, we're only male or a female. If you know anything about biology, you'll recognize that there are actually quite a few species that can switch sexes. There are fish that under certain conditions, a female will switch to become a male. They're a schooling kind of fish. And when the main male dies or gets eaten by somebody and there's no male around, I'm not sure how they decide which one's gonna do this, but one of the females will switch. And I mean, within a few days, will go from being a full-fledged female fish to being a full-fledged male fish that can mate with all these other females. Now that's pretty dramatic. There are other species of amphibians, and there are species of reptiles that can do similar kinds of things. We also see all sorts of other kinds of sexual expression among monkeys and apes, whether it be homosexuality or trans. We see in cattle, for example, transsexual cattle. In fact, years ago, there was a problem among sheep herders. They had male rams that weren't doing their job, and they call them non-productive rams. Turns out they were gay rams. They were having, and other farmers noticed in the 1920s and 30s, and some early veterinarians noticed that there were real interesting configurations of sex among cattle, so that sometimes you had cattle that weren't clearly male or female, or, as in humans, we now know that some humans are born with all the male equipment, but it doesn't descend till much, much later, among other things. So what they began discovering in the 1930s, 40s, even 50s, and then the research kind of got slammed down, when the when the repressed evangelicals came out in the 50s and started trying to stop research. Alfred Kinsey was, among other people, was vilified for his research on human sexuality. What they were starting to find was hormones really have an enormous impact on how people express their sexuality, how animals express their sexuality, how sex and gender evolve, both psychologically and biologically. So I think, it's kind of the way I look at it, is sex is a hormonal journey through life. If you're producing certain kinds of hormones or certain combinations of hormones, you may have a sex drive that goes one direction. If you got a different set, you may have a sex drive that goes another direction. I'm going to come back and talk about that because that's not all of it. I'm not saying hormones are everything. I'm just saying they have an influence over who we are. And if you don't believe me, go take some testosterone or take some testosterone blockers. See what happens. And not just testosterone. There's other sex-related hormones. Testosterone gets way over exposed. It doesn't do all the things people say it does, but it does do some things to some degree. So I want to get into two hormones that many people are not really familiar with. And that's, you may have heard of oxytocin, but I'm guessing most of you have never heard of vasopressin. Oxytocin is what is expressed in the human female to dilate the cervix. It's the natural dilation system. It also is what lets milk down in the breast. It also is what makes a woman, a person who owns a vagina and a clit, makes them have sexual expression, get turned on, helps them have orgasm. Oxytocin is a multi-purpose hormone, and it does a lot for females. Now, males produce oxytocin as well, but not to the same degree. What males have is a similar, not quite identical hormone called vasopressin. And it tends to be involved in bonding. So oxytocin is a bonding within certain limits. Oxytocin is a bonding hormone, primarily comes in bonding for females. Vasopressin is more involved in bonding for males. Now, I want to say both create the same hormones. They just do it in different proportions. And I'm oversimplifying this shit all over the place. So, you know, if you get in here and read, oh, it's not quite that way. Okay, I'll agree. Probably not that way. But these two are very important in how we bond, how milk is let down in the breast, how orgasms happen. I mean, there's a lot of things going on that are influenced by oxytocin, vasopressin. So again, sexuality is a hormonal journey, but it's also influenced by culture. Now, before I leave this page, I want to just give you a little experiment that was done about 15 years ago. There was there's a species of vole called the prairie vole that is monogamous, which, as we've seen, is a pretty rare thing. There's not very many species on this planet that are monogamous. And they researched what was causing this monogamy, and they discovered that there's another species of vole that looks and appears to be identical, but they are not monogamous and they don't mate with each other. It's almost like they're different species. So they studied both, and what they identified was oxytocin, that the species that had produced lots of oxytocin were monogamous. The species that did not produce lots of oxytocin were not monogamous, especially among the males. So they did a simple experiment. They put an oxytocin blocker into the prairie voles so that they couldn't produce as much or respond to oxytocin. And guess what happened? The prairie voles started being non-monogamous. They lost their monogamy overnight just because of a single hormone. these are really interesting experiments. Now, of course, we can't necessarily do those experiments on humans, but when you look at every single species that has strong pair bonding and among mammals, and oxytocin is implicated in that, it's not a large leap to say, well, maybe oxytocin has something to do with whether somebody can or does bond with somebody else. I'm not giving people excuses here. I'm just trying to explain why it may be more difficult for some people to bond than for other people. It has nothing to do with being a lech or not being caring for anybody else. There might be other hormonal reasons. I don't know. I'm not here to diagnose anybody. Now, the last thing I said there was, it's a hormonal journey, but it's also strongly influenced by culture. There was a really interesting book that came out about 15 years ago called Sexual Fluidity. And they had this woman studied 200 women. She's a PhD psychologist. And she studied about 200 women over a period of 10 years, starting from about the time they graduated from college, I think it was, until they were into their 30s. She found some really interesting stuff. It's a rather long book. I don't necessarily recommend you read it because it's very academic, but it has some really interesting findings. One of those findings was women changed their sexual expression, even their gender identity, fairly easily through the 10-year time period. In other words, they were fluid in the way they expressed themselves. They may have been very cis, heterosexual to begin with, and ended up in a gay relationship 10 years later, or vice versa. She did not study men. All she studied was women. But what we've seen is over the years, women in the research so far, the women seem to be about 5 times more identified as what would be called bisexual. She used those terms, bisexual. So women were 5 times as likely to identify as bisexual as men were. I don't doubt that that's probably true. However, our culture really doesn't like bisexual men. There's quite a few, quite a bias against bisexual males. There's less of a bias against bisexual females. So there could be some cultural influence here, 5 to 1. I'm just guessing. Now, maybe if we had true, if we could really get down to the basis of it, it might be 5 to 2 or 5 to 3. I don't know. But what she found was females tend to identify as bisexual more than males do. My guess is only the cultural piece there. So I don't want to say it. There's research necessarily showing that. Okay. Before I move on, I want to just underline that this hormonal change also might be taking place as we go through life. I know my sex drive is still pretty high for a 70-year-old man, but it ain't nearly what it was when I was 30 or 40. I'll tell you that much. So what's going on? Well, it's because hormones are changing. My body's not producing as many. I'm sure thankful for Viagra and Cialis that makes a great sex life when you're my age. But it's the reason you need those two, one or those kinds of drugs, is because your body is not producing the chemicals and the hormones that it used to produce. So as I said, life is a journey, a hormonal journey. Sexuality is a hormonal journey through life. At every stage in life, your body is expressing different concoctions of hormones. If you don't believe me, you're a female and you have a baby, you're probably going to notice how many different feelings you have that you didn't have before, or how the hormones are expressed, how much you like or don't like breastfeeding. When there's lots of things that are going on in the female body that are related to the way hormones are happening. And the same kind of thing could be happening to males, although they don't give birth, so they don't go through some of the kind of physical changes that females experience. Okay, here's an interesting idea. Are we breeding ourselves? As you know, peacocks, if you've ever read any books about evolution, you know, there's a peacock effect. And that is that the females are choosing the male that has the most brightly colored tails. And the male that can strut around and show a brightly colored, flawless tail is incredibly attractive to the female peahen. Going back to the very first thing I said today, it appears that that is a sign that the peacock has a low parasite load. They can afford to expend lots of energy on brightly colored tail feathers because they're not fighting parasites. This seems to be true, widely true among birds. A colorful male bird is able to attract females because it is a marker for strength, for resistance, and resistance to parasites. Now, if you're a female, you want to have babies that can resist the parasites that are in the local environment. So it's pretty clear that this is a radical, radical body changing thing for peacocks to be able to mate. And if it's all related to parasites, that means that female peacocks are literally choosing to, not consciously, but they're influencing the way the body displays in a peacock. A peahen is selecting. It's called sexual selection. Darwin discovered it and wrote about it 150 years ago. So are we doing this to ourselves? And there's some evidence that we are actually breeding ourselves. This is, when you think about it, it sounds pretty bizarre. But I mean, when you go, if you go on, and I haven't dated online in quite a while, but what's that? You swipe right if you like them, swipe left if you don't like them. Is that what it is? Eric, you're a, you don't date.
I wasn't supposed to say that.
No, I know, right? I don't know. Swipe right sounds.
Yes.
Would you say, Kara? Right.
Yeah, can confirm.
Okay.
Like.
So when you swipe right to like, thank you, Kara. I have not used that particular app before, so I wasn't sure. You swipe right. There's some characteristics there that you're very quickly responding to in your brain. There's a facial configuration. There's a, you know, how's the facial hair distributed? Do they have a beard? Are they blonde? You know, there's all sorts of things that are happening in your brain at an instant because you're swiping really quickly if you're using that app. Well, let's just think about it. We've been swiping right and swiping left for the last 4 million years or more. That's what you do when you mate or when you decide to mate or when you consider a mate, you're swiping right or left. And so that's what is happening in some cultures. So that leads me to the biological phenomena of stetopygia. I'll bet you've never heard that word before, but you've probably seen pictures of it and didn't know it. There, at one point in time, this was a body phenomena across a wide swath of Africa, mostly in East Africa, but it is common in South Central Africa most now. That is enormous deposits of fat in the buttocks and upper legs. We've seen this. We know what it looks like. You've seen pictures of it, but it's called stetopygia. And it is considered extremely attractive within the cultures in which it occurs. In other words, big butts may make really attractive mates. Now, I'm not here to say whether it's whether it makes them more fertile or not. We don't know. I mean, just because a peacock's got beautiful feathers does not necessarily mean they're more fertile, but it is a marker. And perhaps as humans, at least within that area where there's high parasite loads and central Southern Africa has tons of parasites, that might be a marker for a female that's resistant to parasites. So I want to mate with a female that can be produce offspring that are not going to die soon after because of a parasite load. Now, I'm just hypothesizing. Nobody knows exactly why Ctenopygia exists, but at one point in time, it was enormously widespread in Africa. With the influence of Western culture, it has been, and probably other things, maybe because parasites are being more under control, it is less and less attractive. In fact, there's an interesting book written by I'm forgetting the name of the book. It was about a detective agency in Botswana. It's a fun little read. I think there's a whole series of books on it. It's about this little detective agency, and she investigates things about a woman. And one of the comments she makes in the book is that women with large butts are no longer attractive in our culture. You can't attract men if you've got a large butt in our culture. And yet 100 years ago, you had to have a large butt in order to attract men in that culture. That shows you the influence of culture, because now the image of Western females is getting put on their televisions and their books, their magazines. Suddenly men are getting inundated with an image of what's attractive that's very different than what they would have been taught or shown 100 years ago. You may think I'm just creating all sorts of crazy ideas here, but there's another piece of this that I've personally observed. If you ever go to Northern England, especially over Northern Wales, right in the border in that area, you might observe that a surprising number of women have incredibly large breasts. I was blown away. I've never seen anything quite like that. And it's everywhere. Now I'm a breast man, so that makes life very fun for me, or interesting. So what is going on there? Maybe it's the same thing that we see with Ctenopygia. We do know that culture has a direct impact on our genetics. That's obvious, because if you can drink milk, if you can tolerate lactose, then you are direct descendants of a herder people. Maybe 1,000, maybe 2,000 years ago, those people learned, genetically I'm speaking, learned how to drink milk, which led to high survivability among everybody, because you can take your food source with you. You can't eat grass, but that cow can. So you herd cattle, you drink their milk, you survive. The child that can't drink milk in a grassland where there's plenty of grass but no food, they better learn to drink milk or they're going to die. And because they can't tolerate milk, they probably will die. So we've got evidence across the globe. Anytime you find a herder society that milks their cattle, their sheep, their horses, those people have lactose tolerance. And that's genetic. We actually know that particular gene was introduced within the last 5,000 years in humanity. There's actually more genes than that. I could talk about other genes like sickle cell anemia. That's a gene that was introduced to resist malaria. Now it's got horrible side effects under certain conditions, but it protected people against malaria. That was probably the reason, that was the main reason it came into common use. And many people don't realize it, but there's multiple ways to resist malaria genetically, not just the sickle cell concept, but some other ways too. I think there's three or five different genetic variations that help protect people against malaria. So again, we know that genes are changing, and they're changing in relation to culture and environment and parasites. All these things are happening. So what I will say about humans is that sex is got many aspects to it, many functions, but it's for bonding, it's for pair bonding, it's for recreation, it's for health. I've named all of those things already. And the fact that we have thousands, maybe tens of thousands of sex acts for every live birth tells us that birth is not the main reason. Reproduction is not the main reason for having sex. It's one reason, but it's not even the most important reason. It's apparently most important for health and for body. We know more and more that people who have good sex lives are generally more mentally healthy as well. They don't suffer from depression, loneliness, isolation. You know, they don't have the kind of problems that people who don't have good sex lives have oftentimes. So we know it's got health benefits for mental health. We also know it's got health benefits for physical health. We've already talked about what happens to the female reproductive tract when they're masturbating a lot. We also know that the female reproductive tract is generally healthier, period, when the vagina owner is actually having lots of sex. So I hope this helps you understand that sex has got a lot of other functions besides reproduction. And yet the Pope only knows one purpose for sex, and that's reproduction. And that's oftentimes true of a lot of other people, a lot of other religious leaders as well. So sex serves many purposes for many different species. Many species only use sex for reproduction. That's all they use it for. But there are many species that have other purposes for it. I mean, clearly bonobos have other purposes for sex, and so do the chimps. I can name several other primate species that use sex for other things, mainly bonding. And of course, we've already talked about the oxytocin produced by the prairie voles, and that's where sex and the bonding that comes from it, from the oxytocin is. So here's the final word here. Don't try to put your round or oval or star-shaped or open or pink or wet, beautiful sexuality into the square hole of religion or Western culture. Western culture has been deeply influenced by Christian theology and Christian views of sexuality. And that includes Islam. Islam is deeply influenced by ideas that came out of the Middle East that are thousands of years old and have no relationship to actual science. So what I'm going to suggest that you learn to create sex for what it means to for you. You have to identify, as we've heard from some of our other speakers, you create meaning for your own life. And I'm here to tell you, you create your sexuality for your own life as well. Don't let anybody else tell you what your sexuality should or shouldn't be. This is the only life you're going to get, and you might as well enjoy it to the fullest. And sex is an important part of that life. It's not the only part. There's certainly more to life than sex, but it's a big piece of it. And more we see people who have healthy sex lives generally have, and largely, better lives in general. So integrate sex into your life so that you can have a healthy life. If you need help with that, find some therapist, find a sex therapist, find somebody to talk to that can just understand and listen to you. And hopefully from this talk, you've gotten some challenging ideas that you can take and maybe apply in other places and think about what kind of sexuality you want to use and have in your own life. Thank you, Eric and Kara. That's everything.
Dr. Ray, thank you so much for this discussion. We have got quite a few questions. Kara, you want to start off with the first one?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got quite a few. One question that we got early on in the lesson was, how does all this relate to people who are asexual? Where do they fit into this discussion and these descriptions?
That's a really good question, and I'm going to apologize for not being fully inclusive. Sometimes I just get too focused on pieces. But yeah, even I don't care who you are, every cell in your body is sexual. Now, whether you express it or feel the need to express it, that's a whole nother question, totally. I see asexuality as kind of a spectrum as well, and I'm going to go out on a limb here because there's not been a lot of research around this. So don't take what I say here as the gospel truth. I said earlier on, sexuality is a journey through life with hormones. If you added a hormone or took away a hormone, I might become asexual. It's that simple. I don't know what is going on in the body of somebody who's identifying as asexual, but I do know some people are asexual at age 24, but they're not at age 35. So things might change. I don't know. You know, it's a big unknown. But what is important is no matter how you identify, no matter how you express your sexuality, it's your sexuality. And I've seen a lot of asexual people taking the bull by the horns, basically, and saying, look, I'm asexual. I'm not ashamed of it. It's no big deal. It's just the way I am. Get over it. And that's kind of my attitude. So I hope that answers that person's question. I probably have a dozen friends, people I know pretty well over the years that are identify as asexual. And we've talked about this a lot, and they've told me about how crazy it is to be asexual in a church that says you have to get married and have kids and all that kind of bullshit. So I know once you're in that, I think there's quite a bit of oppression and repression of that identity within religion. You won't get that recovering from religion. We don't give a shit. You can be whatever you want. We love you anyway. Anyway, we love you, period.
This is kind of veering off into a completely different talk that we should and will have in the future, but it's almost sounding like an individual's sexuality isn't necessarily fixed throughout their entire life. Like you had mentioned that hormones change over time and their preferences could change over time as well.
I'm very sure preferences change over time. And you can look at the kink community, for example, and you can see that over a period of years, decades even, people's kinks change. And why are they changing? I don't know. Could be because of hormone changes. I've noticed that many people don't really come into their kink until they're well into almost 40 or later. I don't know what's going on there. And maybe it's just a fluke observation. But anyway, there's lots of things going on. Your body, from year to year, your body is not the same. You may feel like you're the same, but there's different ratios of hormones coming in and out of your body. I mean, so you may feel like I'm the same person I was at 35 that I was at 25, but you're not. Those hormones that you're having at 35 are having a different influence on you. And that influence influences you at a subconscious level. It's you may not even know it's there. You probably won't know it's there. So anyway, I could go on and on about that, Eric. You're right. Might be a whole nother discussion. And I'm sure we've got people in the Secular Therapy Project that could do that kind of discussion better than I could.
The next question we have, it might be a fairly simple answer, but what is the difference between cheating and non-monogamy?
Good question. Very simple. Integrity. We had a speaker here a few months ago, Dr. Stephen Davidson, who, by the way, is coming out with a new book called Sexual Integrity. Would go figure. I don't know. You remember him?
Had him on RFRX. He might have been in court.
Well, no, I think he was here. Oh, well, maybe not. Well, if we haven't, we need to get him, especially with his book. I just had the privilege of reading the manuscript copy of the book and endorsing it. It's awesome book. Really, it's some cool clinical stuff that everybody should be.
We did. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was pretty sure we did. But we need to get him back on because he can really speak to a lot of things at much better than I do. He's a clinician that's been in the practice for 30 years. The guy really knows his stuff. So anyway, what's the difference between cheating and non-monogamy? Was that your question?
Yeah, and I think answered it beautifully.
Well, I want to answer it a little bit more, and that is people who are non-monogamous are very open and honest about what they want and how they're going to go about doing it. And then they agree to certain practices and they stick by those practices. They have a lot of integrity about that. People who cheat are not expressing themselves honestly to their partner, or they have too much fear about expressing themselves. and oftentimes are afraid of losing their partner, which may be a reasonable fear. I am not going to condemn people who cheat. That's not my thing. I don't think that's, I think there are good reasons for people to cheat. I've seen, I think there's sometimes situations in life where it's almost impossible not to. So let's just get that straight. I don't condemn anybody for how they chose to behave at a certain time in their life. But I think ultimately our goal is to be, have as much integrity as possible. And I know when I was in incredibly deep crisis around my own sexuality, I would look back and say, wow, I was not in control of myself in ways that I thought I was. Remember, I told you the hormones are influencing you. Well, sometimes those hormones, I'm not giving people excuses for hurting other people, but I'm saying sometimes we don't even know what we're doing and why we're doing it. So I try to walk that fine line. I have lots and lots of friends that quote cheated. And I don't think they're any better or worse people than somebody who didn't cheat. But I know all of them would have liked, almost all of them would have liked to be able to be honest with their partner. Oftentimes their partner was deeply religious and there's no way for them to talk about this stuff. Their partner simply wouldn't talk about it. Well, how do you have an open, honest, integrity relationship if you can't talk? So anyway, I could go on and on about that as well, Eric. But you should get Dr. Davidson on to talk about that.
Will do.
Well, I've got another question here that you could probably go on and on about for a while. Someone was wondering what your thoughts are on initial impressions and sexual attraction when we first see someone, and how much of that might be genetic and how much is cultural?
Oh, that's a great question. And there's actually quite a bit of research that's done on that. And the answer to the question, as you might expect, is some of it's genetic, a lot of it is cultural. Remember I talked about the steatopygia. That's clearly cultural, and yet it's influenced genes. I mean, we're selecting people based on how big their butt is as sexually attractive potential mates. So that is a psychological, cultural thing, but it's having direct impacts on somebody else's genes. And we see the same thing probably in large breasts. Why do Japanese women have almost no breasts when Northern Welsh women have enormous breasts? There's something going on there, and it's got to be related to sexual selection. I think we have evidence that women are attracted to certain facial configurations in men, depending on where they are in their menstrual cycle. There's actually been quite a bit of research on that. And shows that when women are most fertile, they choose face, and this is like in a dating site. They just say put the facial configurations on the screen, say, you know, choose between these men. And men with the most masculine facial configurations are chosen more often by women when they're in the height of their fertility. When they're not in their height of fertility, their less masculine men are chosen. Now that research is pretty robust. It actually goes back quite a few years now. So we're pretty darn sure that whatever hormones and whatever psychological stuff is going on there, it's probably genetic as well, women's brains are being impacted in their choices of potential, well, mates, I'm not sure, but at least the male facial configurations. And there's other research around that. And we know that human babies are deeply programmed to recognize the human face very early on. Within days after being born, a baby can recognize the human face. Within weeks after being born, a baby can recognize their particular mother's face against other females' faces. So right there, if facial recognition software is built right into our genetics, it wouldn't surprise me at all that facial recognition software is being implemented in, you know, the choice of dating of potential partners. Does that answer the question? Do you think that answers the question? Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
We got another question here. It's a couple parts about when you talked about the penis pump and like how it works with humans, which is a fascinating part of the discussion. Compared to uncircumcised penises, how does the penis pump work? The mechanism works similar with circumcised penises? And then what about condoms as well?
Yes, condoms, of course, are a human invention that's fairly recent and has nothing to do with genetics. let me answer the first question. The performance, quote unquote, performance of the circumcised penis versus the uncircumcised penis isn't really much different. What has been observed is that the uncircumcised penis enters the vagina more easily than the circumcised one was. I mean, if you just think you've got a sheath there, and when the sheath goes into the vagina, the sheath pulls back, but the penis keeps going. So there's less resistance. That's what's going on with the circumcised penis. Now, once the penis gets in there, once the penis is extended, the coronal rim is just as pronounced with a circumcised as an uncircumcised, and it's still gonna be able to pump out. Because you remember, when the penis is not extended, the foreskin is covering the corona. So you've got, got that loose skin covering it until it's fully extended, and then it doesn't cover it anymore. I mean, just look at pictures of that picture I showed you earlier of the human penis. It was uncircumcised. The first part of it, it was a flaccid penis that was uncircumcised, but it's the same penis when it was erect, and you can't even tell. You almost can't tell if it's circumcised or not once it's fully extended. So I don't, in terms of condoms kind of change the shape of the penis so that the coronal edge is not as pronounced. So it's probably not pumping. So, if there's sperm up in the vagina, the cervix, probably going to get the cervix and fertilize a baby if there's already sperm up there, because your condom's probably not going to pump it out as well. There you go. Fun facts to know and tell. That's what this should be.
This doesn't quite sound like pub trivia.
It should be, though. Get that information out there. And we've actually got another one kind of along those same lines, referring to cleaning the pipes, as it were, with masturbation, specifically for vagina owners. Does it matter what type of stimulation is used? For example, if someone is relying on clitoral stimulation versus something that is more penetrative, does it still have the same health benefits or, cleaning out the pipes kind of effect?
It may or may not. And I'm not deeply into that level of research, but I do know there has been some research, and there's probably some hormonal things going on between the human penis and the reproductive tract of the female. Mm-hmm. And some of that may be stimulating the female system to resist disease. We know for a fact that the penis carries bacteria and yeast and things into the vagina. Well, what's going to happen in the vagina if it can't resist those things? So there's clearly a stimulation of the immune system if a penis is being used versus a dildo, for example. Or if you're just stimulating the clit and having an orgasm with just clitoral stimulation, then there's that penetration is not going to stimulate. And maybe a dildo will stimulate it, but the dildo is, you're probably going to clean the dildo, so you're not going to be bringing, shit in that a penis might. There's a lot going on there. And there's no doubt that a real penis brings things into the vagina that the vagina has to deal with, and the two get in balance. I don't know if you're a vagina owner, you probably noticed that when you change partners, you may get a yeast infection. And this is actually pretty common. Ask any gynecologist, anybody that deals with vaginas, and they will ask, have you changed sex partners? Yeah, oh, well, that's probably, he's bringing in a different yeast that your body's not used to yet. We'll get you over this infection, keep having sex, you'll probably get used to it, and your body will get a new balance with the new yeast. It works that way. Is that sound true? Sound reasonable?
So it's like making yogurt in the crock pot or
okay.
Probably not at all like that.
No, but you know, we don't think about these things from a biological perspective as much. And I've had many partners that got yeast infections after we had our first, you know, sexual encounter. I've seen it way too many times in my life. So I know it happens, but the female tract generally becomes used to it or finds a way to manage it. It's like any other, you know, you'd be around somebody with a cold, you might get the cold or you might, but you also might gain immunity to that cold in some way, shape or form. You know, we're biological creatures. You can get all sorts of things from each other. You know, you can get a, you can get a yeast infection or you can get a cold from your partner.
Fair enough.
Dr. Ray, we've got another question here, and I'm going to kind of read it as it was sent to me because, yeah, it's important. The details are. I didn't have sex until I was married at 30 and married a man based on the criteria my religious leaders told me to. My whole life, I suppressed my sexuality and confessed the rare times I did masturbate to church leaders, starting when I was 17. I'm now married to a man that has never really satisfied me in bed. We've been married for over 5 years and we have a son together. I fantasize about having wild sex with a guy I dated but I never had sex with because of the church. I want to be able to explore my sexuality and feel comfortably or completely satisfied in my life, but I can't stay married to the husband and do that. It feels kind of stuck. What kind of thoughts do you have on that or suggestions?
Well, without knowing any more than what you just read, it sounds like this person has given up on the marriage or the possibility of a good sex life within this marriage. If that's the case, then I would, you know, you probably have some obligations you want to make sure to try and fulfill if you can be honest with your partner, but you also don't want to hurt them. I mean, they are in the same position you are. They married you because of the criteria. Now, the fact that the criteria were bullshit doesn't change the fact that they've got feelings and you've got feelings. So you might try some therapy to begin with. Because sitting down in a room with a therapist who knows what they're doing and expressing how you feel is interesting. If you can get each other in the same room, I have seen this happen more than once, that one highly religious person wants a better sex life, but doesn't know how to get it. The other person is leaving and ready to leave if the sex doesn't change. When they go to a therapist and they sit down and talk, they realize that both parties have the same ideas and same needs, but they couldn't tell each other because of the shame the religion taught them. Too many religious couples cannot talk to each other because they're ashamed of their own bodies, ashamed of their desires, ashamed that they masturbate, ashamed they like to look at porn. I mean, look at all the shame. And we've talked about this in other talks. So I would say if you can find a therapist, sit down and talk to them a few sessions to try and get over the shame and try to determine an exit strategy that will be least painful to both sides. And I think that is so difficult, but I think it's important for the healing. It's important for the healing that will happen after you get divorced. Find a reasonable exit strategy if you possibly can. I will just tell you that when I got divorced the first time, after 17 years of marriage and two kids, I'm bragging. I'm gonna tell you, we both sat down in a rational way and say, how can we dissolve this marriage in the most positive way? She had had an affair and I was pretty upset about that, but that's a side point. She had a good reason to go out and cheat. Okay. So I'm not going to blame her for that. What we did was we found a therapist. We had a few sessions. Then we found a mediator. We both decided, okay, this marriage is irretrievable, but we still care for each other. So we're going to find a mediator. We found a social worker that was trained in mediation, and they helped us in, I think we did it in four or five sessions, and it was worth every penny of it. We got everything on paper, and then the sixth session, we signed it off, took it to a lawyer. Lawyer looked at it and said, yep, this is great. He had one suggestion. We changed it. We took that to the judge and got divorced. And we have had a good divorce. We're still reasonably friends. We've raised two kids that way. So I always think if you can find a good exit strategy from a marriage, that's the best way to go. You may not be able to, maybe there is no way to negotiate. So you end up having to pay lawyers a whole bunch of money, which I'm very, and you hurt each other. You hurt each other more. I hate seeing people hurt each other. So do the best you can. We're all human. We have options. Try to use those options. The other thing is, once you do get divorced, once you move on, I will just say this, almost all of us, and that includes me, go somewhat wild after we get out of a repressive marriage. And we probably do things we probably shouldn't do. So I'm just telling you, expect that. Know that that's probably going to happen. Find a good therapist to work through this with. Keep seeing the therapist after you get divorced so that you won't do some dumb things. Because I did some dumb things after I got divorced. I'm not proud of. But I also don't think I was in control of my own emotions and certainly not my own hormones. So I think being realistic about who we are, what our options are, how we go about dissolving a marriage, how we go about healing from that, how we go about rediscovering our sexuality, every one of those things is a big task and they takes time and it's best done with some help. So that's what my answer to that.
What kind of therapist would you recommend? Like a regular therapist or sex therapist?
Well, for the exploration part, I think start with just a regular therapist. Just start with somebody from the secular therapy project or somebody who's good, well qualified. That's the way I would start. I don't think you need to go to a certified sex therapist. And now if you get in this session and all of a sudden your partner opens up and releases and says, I'm the same way. I'm frustrated too. I don't know how to do this. And you want to explore some more. Then you might say, well, let's go find a sex therapist and explore this. But I'm pretty doubtful that a highly religious partner is going to be ready to do that. I mean, that's a pretty big bridge to cross, so to speak.
Thanks, Dr. Ray.
Yep.
Yeah, I really like that you mentioned that. I can relate as well to mediation and, counseling. It's worth the money for when you're entering a new phase of life.
It really is. I tell you, people say, oh, it costs too much money. Well, I tell you, you're going to spend a lot more on lawyers.
Absolutely. Now,
no disrespect to our lawyer leader, Gail Jordan. But she's a trained mediator, so she would be a good person to talk to.
Yes.
I just think mediation, if at all possible, use mediation to dissolve a marriage. You are both going to be healthier in the long run because you won't have, it's painful when you continually hurt each other. When you're continually stabbing each other, it's kind of hard to heal from the wounds. And mediation, I'll tell you how my mediator started, our mediator rather. We walked into his office, we sat down, he had a watch, and he looked at his watch and says, okay, I'm going to give you guys 5 minutes to yell at each other, and then we're going to get down to business. I'm not going to allow you to yell at each other anymore. And we both looked at each other and thought, we've yelled at each other a lot the last few months. I don't think we need to do that anymore. And we got down to business and we got the business done. It was very healing for both of us, I think, to go through that mediation process. And this is not a advertisement for Gail Jordan, but I would endorse her as a mediator any day of the week.
Yeah. Why go through a process like that with an adversarial model when you could go through one where you're communicating with each other in a healthy way?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
As a psychologist, and I always say this over and over again, I don't want people to hurt. This is the only life you've got. Don't spend it hurting somebody else and being hurt by that somebody else. Learn how to be adults and dissolve a marriage as adults, and you're going to both be better off 10 years from now, much better. You're way ahead of the game. Mediation is really the best way to dissolve a relationship, I think.
Couldn't agree more. Okay, we have time for one more question, and I think I know what the answer to this is going to be, but I think it's a good one. What do you think about the research such as Dr. Drew's research on sex addiction, and do you think that's a thing? And what can you tell us?
Well, let me just say that Dr. Drew is an asshole and doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about. And so Dr. Drew does not know how to do research on this. So that's the first answer to the question. The second answer to the question is, if you really want to know my answer, go watch my talk at Free Thought, Free OK. It's a comprehensive talk I did. We can even put the link up here maybe a little bit later.
Yeah.
I did a 1-hour talk on the myth of sex addiction. I will also reference you to you the book by a friend, a colleague of mine, Dr. David Lay, spelled L-E-Y, his last name. His book, The Myth of Sex Addiction. It's an entire book on the subject. And nothing that he writes about in the book has changed since he wrote the book about, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. People have trouble with sex. I am not going to say people don't have trouble with sex. But the notion of sex addiction is a religious concept. It is not a scientific concept. And so the title of this talk today was Sex and Science of Sex. Part of that is you got to have a scientifically valid way to diagnose something before you go calling people that. We have no scientifically valid way to identify sex addiction. So at this point in time, there is no such thing. That's not to say people don't have trouble with sex. People do. But we're not going to call it addiction. We may say you have a compulsion. We have a gambling compulsion. I don't like the word addiction for gambling. I don't like the word addiction for almost anything because it's so damn hard to define. I could go on and on about the whole addiction thing, but let's just settle it with the bottom line. Addiction is not something you apply to sex. It's something I'm not even comfortable with applying it to a lot of other things like alcohol or drugs. Use common psychological and scientific criteria. If somebody says you're a sex addict, ask them who diagnosed it. It's probably their mother-in-law. It's probably their ex-spouse, probably, somebody like that, or their ex-wife, whatever. So the notion of sex addiction is a religious idea that goes back to about 1982. And Dr. Patrick Carnes is the one that put forth the notion. He has had no research. He has done no research, period, that validates that concept. And the one survey he did put out is a fucking nightmare. When I did that talk at Free OK, I handed his survey out to about 300 people. About half of those people got the survey finished before the time to talk about it. And what we found out was about 80% of the people in the room are sex addicts, according to his survey. Now think about that. If 80% of the people are anything, that means it's probably not a thing. So get rid of the notion. There's no way to diagnose it. There just isn't.
Dr. Ray, thank you so much. Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief.
Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.